I've had a number of lessons over the past 6 or 7 years. That a lot of them have to do with the a reimagining, a reconsideration of the appropriate scale to be working at for the kind of change that I know is possible. And it's been both humbling, surprising, and really amazing and beautiful. And and I feel like a lot of those lessons have a lot also to do with our practice and the process of change, the pace of change, the scale of change, our fantasies and reality, all of that. So, you know, Michelle's mentioned that I moved to Hawaii about 4 years ago to help her and help Steve with some of the work of Vipassana Hawaii, including, you know, teaching there on the islands, but also to help with this project of the Hawaii Insight Meditation Center that they were involved in and had spent many years working toward the creation of a meditation center on the Big Island. And so by the time I showed up, so much work had already happened, and the land had finally actually come into ownership for the organization. And so there was sort of this, you know, I was sort of coming in at the time of like, okay, is this next phase toward the creation of a place going to happen and feasible and doable and viable? And amazing to see just, you know, even in the time that I've been involved, never mind all the work that they and many others have put in over many years to manifest this, that we were able to do so much in the last 4 years that was just really beautiful and incredible, you know, with very little resources, financial resources, or even human resources. You know, we're a sort of small team, a very small team, trying to kind of make a go at this, raising the money, doing land conservation easements to try to sort of afford to start the building process, and, you know, all this stuff that required all kinds of skills that we did not have at the time and learned to the best of our abilities. And just really wonderful to go through that process and just kind of be involved in this work that was, of course, had this vision and an outcome that was aiming for, but also really just seeing that how deeply motivated it was by caring and love and this beautiful aspiration, you know, to create a place that would provide, you know, a beautiful place to practice and something for Hawaii and something for people from off island and a way to protect land that's, you know, becoming harder and harder to do over there from overdevelopment. And so it was 260 acres. It's a lot. It's a lot of land to be responsible for, even if you had a lot of money, which we didn't. And so just this, like, I don't know, very amazing kind of process of seeing, coming to terms eventually with the fact that it just wasn't viable, right? It wasn't feasible. We weren't the people who were going to be able to make this happen. And, you know, everything you can imagine that would feel like, you know, especially for, you know, Stephen and Michelle and others who have been really kind of deeply invested in it for a long time. Hard for me, but also relieved on one hand, you know, that they wouldn't be having to deal with like this running a place. Because I've tried doing that too, and I know how tired, forget the land, just the facility and, you know, retreats and management and, you know, it's very hard. It's a lot of work to try to keep a place like this going, you know, any of the retreat centers. And yet, what was so beautiful is to see that even though this vision wasn't going to happen, that actually these very miraculous and beautiful things have happened, which is to say the folks who now own most of the land, they're Vipassana people, practitioners, and they have the resources to actually build a meditation center. It's not going to be exactly what we envisioned. It's not going to be our retreat center, but it's going to happen. You know, this thing is going to happen, and that land is going to get taken cared for, and people are going to be able to use it, and in this way. And in other ways, you know, they're going to have a kind of a broader scope of programs as well. And then for another huge, you know, almost the rest of the land, we're in a process right now of hopefully getting it into the hands of a local conservation association, you know, as one of their properties. So this kind of very beautiful process of seeing that, like, it just, our resources weren't appropriate, right? There wasn't the sort of ripeness in our organization, or our team, to do this thing that we had hoped for and planned for, worked for, strived for. And yet, what actually is happening is quite beautiful, quite powerful. And I know that it's had everything to do with the practice of, you know, our collective ability to sort of ride these waves of, you know, effort and letting go, of caring, trying to protect the land, trying to feel like what's the actually most important part of this work, you know, what scale can we actually operate at? There's something very resonant to me about that as one example of how we come to practice, right? That we put in so much effort, you know, for folks who are here for the first time for this kind of retreat, that is so much effort. You know, getting here, getting your life in order, getting things together to show up, you know, being here for however many months we've been here already. You know, it's like, it's a lot of work. For people who've been at this for a while, right, it's like there's that deeper sense of like, wow, okay, there's this, that process of like, oh, we're aiming for something big, you know, it may be for full enlightenment. It may be for just a deeper sense of connection with ourselves, with the capacity of the heart and mind to love, to be wise, be a better person on this earth. Even that simple aspiration is actually quite profound, right? And mostly it's humbling, right? Mostly we see over the years that we put in all this beautiful work and we love the practice and we have a deepening faith in its capacity, but are also realize that we can be nourished by these small victories because we see how profound actually a small victory is, right? That just a little bit more softening of the heart, a little more space amid the chaos of life is incredibly transformative, right? Incredibly nourishing to ourselves. Maybe it's just the community of practitioners that we've connected with over the years, you know, that some sense of human connection that supports us, that maintains us. Connection to the tradition or to lineage. Right? It's our most grandiose visions are not always fulfilled in the practice in the time frame we expect them to be. And we come to explore that, right? Oh, the longing of the heart to be free. The willingness to feel that ache. To have it be a healthy motivation, right? Versus something that digs us into more striving and wanting. Chanda, the healthy aspiration, the healthy longing to be free. It's considered a wholesome mind state. And that also that, you know, that experience that, you know, we will have of just seeing the practice flower and flourish in ways that we didn't anticipate, right? That we have our vision of ourselves as we'd like us to be, and that the actual transformations that happen, the actual shifts often come in these surprising moments in ways that we wouldn't have expected or recognized, often actually more powerful than the notions we have in our minds of what it would be like, because it's based on our actual experience, moment by moment. It's the way that it transforms our relationship to our practice is so beautiful and so important, right? Because it's this training to be motivated more by kindness, to be motivated more by genuine interest, and yet to be less and less attached to outcome, right? To a specific outcome. You know, we have to learn this lesson over and over. I mean, it's not like we just learn it once, right? It's in every little nook and cranny, there's a, you know, some level of attachment to a certain kind of outcome for this practice often, you know, and it's okay. It's understandable. It's the best we know at the place we are. And then when we get to the place that we actually end up, oh, we have a perspective on those things that we just couldn't have had before. We understand a little more deeply this relationship between effort and outcome. I had moved from North Carolina, where I had been living for a few years, helping start a retreat center there for social justice activists who are interested in deepening their spiritual practice as a way to support their work. And it was another place that didn't have any money and too much land. And we had 70 acres, a lot of, you know, structures already built. We had purchased the place from another very incredible organization that had done meditation and yoga with people coming out of incarceration. And they were like a spiritual community for a number of years. So it was just like a good heritage of kind of land stewardship. And yet, you know, we were struggling and had all this land, and there was this, you know, part of this big 40-acre field, right? Where we're just like, okay, like, can we use this to make money? You know, is there, how are we going to survive? Is there got to be a way to kind of leverage the value of the land to make money and to support ourselves and to survive, you know? You get all these Catholic monks that are making jams and booze, right? And they're doing all right. We can do that. But they've been doing it, you know, for centuries, and they had plenty of money to start. So, you know, it just wasn't feasible, right? There was just this sense of like, oh, you know, that it's a hilarious fantasy to make money farming, right? This is like, you just talk to any farmer. It's no, you're barely scraping by. You know, people who get into farming now, they're not doing it to make money, you know, or to be famous or to be rich or to be very grandiose, right? It's like, they know that it's good work. They want to have a sense of right livelihood. They feel connected to, you know, the earth in that way. They feel connected to the work of gardening, of support, of community, you know, that they want to play that role and are willing to work really hard for it and suffer for it and have very minimal expectations often of just like trying to keep stable, keep it going. You don't have... So it's very pure. It's very, and it's related to a lineage of, you know, people who have learned farming from, you know, it's like the, if people like, you know, Helen and Scott Nearing so many years ago hadn't started this, you know, kind of movement of going back to the land of you know, going to a remote place and working the fields and trying to learn how to do small scale intensive organic agriculture, this wouldn't exist now, you know? So that's like, and yet they didn't build this movement, but that sort of small dedicated effort, caring, integrity, it had its impact, had its reverberations far beyond any bigger strategy for it. Can we relate to our practice in that way? Right? Like letting go of the kind of the grandiosity. Not that we're not motivated and inspired by the beauty that we maybe have some faith that the heart is capable of. But we also, we're sensitive to that, what Michelle was talking about earlier, that sense of better than, less than, equal to, you know, how much of our motivation is invested in an identity of someone who can love everybody, or how much we'd like to be the person that heals the relationships in our lives or in the world. We may not be operating on that. It might not be that conscious, right? But there's some level of like, oh, right. Can we scale down? Can we be very careful about the integrity of just this moment, just this small patch of land internally that we're trying to practice with? How do we keep that integrity? You know, you can make money farming. You have to do it at an industrial scale. You need like big machines, big operation. So we could do that. Genetically modified mindfulness. But our encouragement is to like not do that. Stay small. Stay committed to the relationships at the base of this practice, right? The relationship with yourself, relationship with the community, you know, teacher, student. There's a carefulness, there's a hope, a capacity of change in that at a scale that's actually manageable and possible that is so important to stay connected to. Even if our work is bigger than that at times, right? Even that we do take on bigger things in our lives than just trying to resolve this, can we stay connected to that and the integrity of that small work as well, right? Karl Marx said about commodities, value is a relationship between people expressed as a relationship between things. Can we keep this practice free from that as a relationship between things? Keep it connected as a relationship between people. This community of practice, of shared protection, shared commitment, when I first moved to North Carolina, I went back to Massachusetts, where I'm from, and paid a visit to an old mentor of mine, Juanita Nelson. She and her husband Wally were organic farmers up in Deerfield, Massachusetts, when I was in high school, and I would kind of go there after school and work on their farm and just get to know them. They were already quite elderly then, and Wally passed away a number of years ago. Juanita just passed away this winter, and they had been so involved in a lot of very beautiful movement work. You know, were very deeply involved in the civil rights movement. And had over time, I mean, so I just got to sit and listen to like these great stories and, you know, living heritage of an era before mine. And so when I went back to go visit her and told her about this, you know, this place I was working in North Carolina, and we had all this land, and she was like, 70 acres is too much. She was like, she's like, we have 1 acre, and we can almost keep up with that. Right? They called it the bean patch, you know. And they were there for, they moved there in this, you know, 40 years, small scale, you know, no electricity, no running water, dedicated to that, so purely dedicated to a life of non-harming, not wanting to participate in the violence of society, right? Motivated by love, but also came to a place where they felt that the scale at which they could do it with integrity was actually small. And that model is actually something that's replicable, transmissible beyond them. And I would, you know, and I was, you know, zipping around, and I still travel. And so you're like, you travel too much, you know. She's like, I used to travel. I used to want to go to all these places. And now, she's like, I realize I don't even know my 1 acre. Every day, I go out and I find something new about it. A corner that I'm not familiar with. A plant growing here. Some quality to this part of the land that I just didn't know yesterday. That it's an endless exploration within this small patch. And this endlessly deepening sense of growth and increasing integrity and kindness and softening of her heart over all these years that was so moving, so powerful, such a powerful lesson to me of like, okay, can, you know, again, we can work at bigger scales. We can, you know, we can do good work in the world. We can work at, try to do bigger projects. It's like, that's, it's beautiful. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's more about, can we also stay connected to this 1 acre bean patch? Can we actually, is it, can that be the source of our deepening understanding, of our deepening kindness and sensitivity? Of just exploring the vast realms just in here. At the very least, as a source for whatever's motivating else, what else we do beyond that. The Buddha said, there's no making an end to suffering and stress without reaching the end of the cosmos. Yet, it is just in this fathom-long body with its perceptions and thoughts that I declare there is the cosmos, the origin of the cosmos, the cessation of the cosmos, the path leading to the cessation of the cosmos. That we have access, that we actually do need to know the whole cosmos, right? That it actually all needs to be known, and yet we have access to it all just in here, you know, and all of it can be a motivation for the development of our understanding. All of it can be the motivation for the development of our kindness, you know, for our compassion, for our joy, and just this exploration. It's like we were saying earlier, you know, to see the aching of the heart, the places where it's knotted, the places where it's gnarled, the places where it's beautiful, where it's open, where it's free. We're not just learning about ourselves, right? We're learning about all people, all beings, right? That these various levels of consciousness of all these other animals and beings in these other realms, they're of the same nature, right? They're dealing with the same fundamental problems. This capacity for understanding that, finding care and compassion, it's unlimited. Just in this little bean patch. And, you know, can we be satisfied with that? You know, that can we really deeply believe that all we need we have within us, right? You can hear a quote like that, you know, so many quotes. Oh my God. You know, on Facebook or whatever, it's just like, quote about this, quote about that. It's like, okay, you know, like, everyone, people have said amazing things. And it's like, can we don't need the quote. We can go there, right? We actually have access to it. The quote can, of course, it's like the Buddha said. What did he say? Like, there's lots of fake Buddha quotes too, right? Yeah. The finger pointing at the moon is not the moon, right? The Dhamma, the teachings, and then there's the experience, right? The deeply known for ourselves. Scrambling at the edge of this 1 acre, thinking that what we need is outside of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Michelle has also mentioned that since I moved there, she lets me stay at a room in her house. And, you know, I try to help with the garden, make chai for my guru. Yeah, a lot of computer administrative work. But it is, you know, it is a very powerful thing of it's like, okay, so there's been all this land on the island, but then there's just, you know, this home and this house, and that I have, you know, put some effort into trying to, you know, help with this garden and take care of this, you know, piece of land. And it's that same thing, you know, a small piece of land is just still hard to take care of. And especially because, you know, I'm on the road a lot. Michelle's on the road a lot. Other people are, you know, it's part of the deal, right? It's part of the nature of our lives. And so, it's like this, you know, it's like you come home and things are a disaster. You know, it's like overgrown and things, the irrigation stopped here and the irrigation exploded over here. And, you know, and that's when we come back to a retreat, that's what it is, right? It's like, oh, right, we have this thing we're supposed to be taking care of, and it's a total mess, you know? And so then, you know, for the period that we're on retreat, the period you get to be home, it's just like, okay, it's work, it's weeding, it's, you know, it's, but it's not all hard, you know, it's like, there's the weeding, there's the trimming, there's the cutting, but then there's the, you know, fixing, and the watering, and the planting, and the you know, putting of new seeds, and trying to put energy into something that we'd have no idea when it's gonna unfold, how it's gonna flourish, you know? These things are, it's unknowable. Anything could happen. This, with this land, with, you know, there's no certainty about the next day. And yet we do it, right? You try to cultivate goodness. You try to create, you try to protect, you try to do something beautiful. You try to create a place that you want to live in here. Back in our home, apartment, wherever it is, right? Our hotel room. It's like, yeah, there's a value to just like, conditions matter. You try to create good, but we also know it's out of our control, ultimately. I'm staying here at this Watson house, this beautiful little cottage, and there's a bigger house there, and they've been doing kind of this very intensive landscaping around. Yeah. You know, it's like, wow. And so I kind of just look at, and I haven't gone and like really explored, but I sort of check it out, and it's like, and then yesterday the landscapers are there and the designers, you know, and going around and checking things out. And so I saw the guy, you know, I was like, oh, are you guys the landscapers? He's like, yeah. I was like, wow, bro, it's really amazing. And, you know, I was like, I think, you know, it's in 80 years, it's going to look awesome. And I realized that could totally be taken the wrong way. He was kind of like, huh. And I was like, I try to say, you know, I was like, well, you know, these, it's all totally new. And when you, but I'm right, right? Or there's a point to that, which is that, like, yeah, right. Or, yeah, it's like when someone else takes over. No, it's like when these, you know, it's all new, it's all fresh, it is all done with beautiful intention. And it takes so much time for certain, you know, plants to come to maturity, right? That you can look at a certain plant, a tree there, and you're going to say, when that tree is actually grown, it's going to be gorgeous. Right now, it just looks like it was just planted there. It's just sort of stuck and it's out of place. Or these plants in this area, you know, they may not grow well together, you know, that over some time you may need to make adjustments, and certain things will sort of soften. The edges of the stone that have been so recently carved will soften, you know, and that over time it can be, you know, deeply, it can become so integrated and mature and ripen and be, you know, integrated into the landscape. I said a small version of that, and he came back. He was like, okay, cool, you know, thanks. Because I really do believe that, you know, it's just to say that, like, in our hearts, in our minds, you know, we just, you don't know how long it's going to take for certain things to come to fruition. You know, we're planting seeds, we're weeding, we're doing all this work. Sometimes we're moving, like, you know, big pieces of land and reshaping things over time, you know, channeling water here, over there. Sometimes we put our energy into something and it's kind of not quite the thing that's ends up being bearing fruit. Other times, you know, it's the sort of persistent, consistent energy going in one direction really creates a lot of beauty, maybe more than we could have imagined, changing with the season. There's a, In North Carolina, we have this persimmon tree, American persimmons. And they're just this incredible fruit that they, at some point in the summer, they just start to look really beautiful. They're bright orange, small. And they look so good, and you know, you want to go for them, but they taste so bad, right? They're so bitter, like aspirin. And then they get older and fall starts to come and things, everything's dying. And you're just sure that this is not a edible fruit ultimately, you know? And then you know, finally it's getting riper and riper, and it looks like it's just withering on the tree, and you eat it and it's mostly sweet. But then at the end, there's just this astringency, you know? It's like, oh, you know, this, and it, you have to wait till it falls from the tree. Right, that there is the ripeness is so beyond what our expectation of it is, or our longing, or our wanting is, that it actually has to fall from the tree, and you have to get it before the possums and the, you know, all the other creatures go for them. And they're, you know, otherworldly delicious once they've fallen. Once that ripeness that is kind of so unfathomable. Once it dies, right? Once it's totally able to let go of that tree, be willing to die, does it have this kind of new life for us to be able to appreciate it? In where we go in Burma, the Sagaing Hills, it's a really ancient area of practice for and study for monks and nuns in particular. And I think it's been about 1,000 years since the first recorded kind of monks and nuns went over there and started carving caves into the limestone to practice in, and a small village arose to help support the practitioners. And since then, you know, it's just covered with monasteries and nunneries and pagodas and, you know, all kinds of temples and these just beautiful stairways and walkways that, you know, monks have been coming down for centuries to come do their alms around in the morning. You know, these just ancient bricks, worn, you know, with just barefoot walking over centuries. And there's a way that the all of the pagodas, they're in a sort of state of decay in the monasteries and erosion. You know, there is not a lot of, especially in the monasteries and nunneries, there's not a lot of energy put into fixing things. There's energy put into building new things. And so you have this sort of very wild sort of landscape of like totally these gorgeous new kind of buildings constantly being put up. And then all these gorgeous old buildings crumbling in a way that's partly sad, but partly quite exquisite as well. And yet to see this in a short turn can have its painfulness. You know, the Sayadaw Ulakana, who had been the abbot of that monastery for so many years and our friend and colleague and teacher, deep inspiration for that retreat and all the work that we've done in Wachet Village. He had just finished a new pagoda at the top of the mountain just before he died last year. Just about a year ago. And so when we went back this January, you could see that even that pagoda just built, the fruit of so much care and kindness and love, devotion, was already starting to fall apart. You know, these brand new, beautiful marble Buddhas inside and out, and yet the stuff around it already, you know, starting to get dusty, get old, start to crumble. Very exquisite, but also hard on the heart, you know, to see that how much continual effort needs to go into something to be maintaining it, you know. And then this year, I decided, because that trip home is so long, I decided I'll try to stay a few days in Kyoto in Japan and take a rest and get to know. I'd never been to Japan, just the airport stops, you know, I stopped there. And it's a wonderful city. And there are these incredible, I mean, these temples and these gardens that are just unbelievably maintained. I mean, also centuries old and just like stunning and immaculate and perfect and so gorgeous, you know. And so very powerful to kind of go into an experience from Burma then to Japan to see these ancient things that are like so perfectly maintained. And yet, you know, there's no one practicing at these parts of the temple you can visit, right? These beautiful, gorgeous places. There's an admission fee. They're basically museums, you know, they're parks that you go in and they support themselves on those fees, and they probably support, I'm sure they support monasteries and people, you know, somewhere, but not there. And so there's this other side of like, okay, how much energy we can put into like that kind of immaculate, total perfection, and yet potentially lose some of the heart, you know, lose some of that quality of the kind of natural, the connection with natural processes of life, right? The natural degradation, falling apart, impermanence. And so that same thing in our practice of just like that, how to be, you know, apply this sort of persistent caring energy over time so that, you know, the it bears fruit, and at the same time to not push so hard, to be so tight with our aspirations, with our sense of perfectionism, that it actually kills the vitality of what we're going for. I'm not saying that's what they're doing. I'm just saying as a metaphor for for our practice. And so a big part of that, of like trying to come to a way of practicing that, especially loving kindness, that is going to do that, that's going to keep us connected, but also not diminish the vitality of what we're doing, is really finding what works. You know, we give you these various tools and these sort of different methods, and I know, you know, sometimes that can be kind of too confusing, like too many different styles. Like, well, should I be doing this or should I be doing that? And sometimes, you know, it's a relief when it's not just, okay, well, this is the way to do it. But at the same time, sometimes it can be hard to figure out kind of what works for us. But we have such a deep faith in the value of that. Because what keeps us going with metta is finding a connection to metta. And if you can't find the connection, you're not going to keep doing it, right? You have to find your way to that place in you, in whatever way works, so that we get that taste and that nourishment from it, so that it's something we develop, a capacity and an interest in going back to. It's and just really to reiterate, it's just not often or always what we think it will be or think it should be. You know, that to really give yourself the exploration, because it'll be worth it. You know, it might feel like you're backtracking or you're not sort of moving ahead at the pace you want, but it's worth exploring what really works. The first time I went on a metta retreat, it was taught in that way, largely around the phrases, which I love. You know, I mean, at this point, the phrases are such a powerful structure to move in and out of. May you be safe. May you be healthy. Or may you be happy. May you be healthy. May you be peaceful. Whatever our version of those are. And the ability to connect with that. But initially, I absolutely couldn't connect with that. You know, it wasn't working, you know, for whatever reason. And I remember on the retreat writing a note. I somehow had this idea. The 23rd Psalm had come into my head. And it was not, I did not grow up in a religious household. It wasn't part of my life in a way that I could pinpoint. But I had this sense of it. and I could only remember certain lines. So I wrote a note to the teachers asking if they could find me a copy and, you know, print it out for me. And they did. And it just worked. And that's all, those were the phrases I did for that retreat. You know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He make me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his namesake. And though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. We can't, who knows, you know, who knows from what part of our lives some peace is going to drop us into quiet, drop us into the sense of safety and connection and caring. there's the forms, there's the exploration. Sometimes we find new forms that work, you know, still in accordance with our tradition. And I never quite knew how to hold that, you know, and I don't use that anymore, but I still have so much gratitude for it, you know, as giving me my first taste of feeling like I could connect with this practice. And then when we were every year I was there in Burma with Sayadaw Ilakana, he would always talk about Jesus. He would have like a whole talk about how much respect he had for Jesus. And here you are in Burma and you don't know, you know, and he would love it. He would go and just how he, cause Sayadaw Ilakana was also a love. He metta practice was clearly, it was just so foundational for him. When he gave a talk, his voice was so gentle and inviting, you know, that you just, And even in Burmese, where, you know, we had a translator, it was just like you just could just listen to him and get that transmission. And, he would say, you know, he would go, you know, talk about love and how important it is. And, you know, that this holy person was important. And he would go through an explanation of how he walked on water and how he turned water into wine. Because in Burma, that's like totally reasonable, right? It's like, okay, it's a concentration. He was a metta guy. He was into concentration. And with that, you can do all kinds of things, you know? So it was just a powerful affirmation for me of like, okay, right, like that, there's a tradition. It's so important. It's so beautiful. It's to stay connected, you know, to receive the goodness of those forms and of those relationships, to keep in relationship. To not break that story. And that there's, you know, there is natural changes in human culture and exploration and that are possible and that are good, you know. And that in our practice we have room to explore like what's gonna work, and that we have the structure to come back to and support us in all the ways we need it. So we're just, you know, we're sitting here, we're planting seeds, we're pulling weeds. We have no idea when the ripeness, you know, when the conditions of the heart, of our lives, of these bodies are going to ripen to bear fruit with some of these seeds. You know, some of it we see more clearly, some of it's more immediate than others, some of it is mysterious and comes to bear fruit at times we have no idea, wouldn't expect. But that's what we're doing, you know, that tending to this 1 acre, taking care of it, learning, watching, caring, seeing, you know, learning about ourselves as we, are we weeding out of aversion? Are we weeding out of care? You know, where is it all coming from internally? What's the motivation? How do we care for that? You know, understand it, understand our own frustrations and hard places, but also aspire toward a more healthy approach. Thoreau talked in an essay he wrote about going on the Concord and Merrimack River in eastern Massachusetts. It's a kind of very slow meandering river for a lot of it on the Concord. And he said that he read somewhere that a piece of land, you only need about an 8-degree difference over a mile to create a flow of water. That's very subtle, you know, that it's not going to be a raging current or white water, right? But that some of these wide, slow rivers, like that's all you need over an entire mile, just an 8-degree difference in height to create enough pull for a flow. That's helpful to me when I think about this practice. It's like, okay, you know, just a little bit of change goes a long way. Moving in the right direction. And the Buddha said, bhikkhus, just as the river Ganges and whatever other great rivers there are, all slant, slope, and incline toward the ocean, so too a bhikkhu who develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path slants, slopes, and inclines toward Nibbana, that freedom of the unconditioned. So just knowing, you know, at times that slope is too hard to notice, right? For us, when we're watching our minds, we're trying to do this practice, we might not be sensitive always to that subtle a slope. But to just have faith to whatever degree we can, that committing to this practice, committing to this process, to exploring the heart and mind and the body and all these sense experiences, trying to do it with integrity, we're inclining, we're sloping, we're slanting toward freedom. Let's sit for a moment.